Jesus, remember us when you come into your kingdom. Please be seated. I won't give away any major spoilers from the movie A House of Dynamite, but the premise alone is terrifying. The first act of the film takes place over the feverish 18 minutes that it takes for a missile launched from somewhere overseas to approach its target in the United States. 18 minutes. I was locked in from the very beginning. But when the characters do their first analysis of where that missile might be headed, launched from a place they couldn't yet locate, and sent over the Arctic, and they look at its trajectory, and they say that the most likely impact is Cleveland, I was like, get the popcorn. I should have been a little bit more scared than that, but I was thinking, well, now we have a movie. Let's see what happens. Well, that was quickly revised to Chicago so that the rest of the country would care. Which I get, I understand that, and it was probably best because then I could stop thinking about Cleveland and just get back to being plain terrified. In those 18 minutes, contingency plans collapse under the weight of chaos. As communication channels that should be connecting our governments to the governments of other potential adversaries, as those channels fall prey to the same dropped calls and iPhone outages that you and I deal with every single day. We didn't know where it came from. Was it the Chinese, the Russians, the North Koreans, a rogue sub-commander, a regime under duress, who saw the obliteration of an American city as appropriate leverage for their own security? And of course, how would we respond? I'm talking Counter-Strike. How would we respond with no information and no time for discernment? Now, I was blessed to grow up a bit after the days of duck and cover, when there was a sense of an immediate impending risk of worldwide doom. I know not everybody here can say the same thing. Many of you remember back to those days, and the likelihood of this kind of a strike went down in the years after, but unfortunately it never got to zero. And our world is such today that sadly we must be paying closer attention to it than ever. Our anti-nuclear proliferation work is ultimately, though, about how nations hold power. It's not just about safety today and tomorrow. It's ultimately about how do we hold power. Just as our anti-racism work and our anti-poverty work is ultimately about what people do with the power that they have, both individuals and as nations. How they get power, how they keep it, how they use it. And throughout history, when we think of power, we think of kings. A king is someone who has a sense of absolute power. They can have anything that they want. But far too often, this has manifested not as servant leadership, but as the kind of extractive power that lines the pockets of whoever sits on the throne. But it's not just kings. It's dictators and CEOs, media moguls and tech magnates, and elected officials who know well how to play the game. I'm not being political here. Okay, I'm being a little political here. But lest you think that I am delivering a no kings homily, I don't actually think that no kings as a political movement is talking about the kind of king that we celebrate today. We are called to look even deeper than the movements of this world, even the ones that are aimed towards creating justice in the world that we have today. To understand Jesus as king, I think that contrasting him with a king from history or an elected official today might be helpful, but not nearly as illustrative as sitting together in that frightening but imagined space of those 18 minutes of existential nuclear anxiety as the bitter fruit of nationhood and mistrust and fear and lust for power rockets towards a deeply unsettling future. The reign of Christ is the opposite of this. It is an eternal reality where our lives are lived not for accumulation or even for security, but for fullness of life in God. This is a big, infinite, expansive view of, well, everything. But when we consider that the one we follow is more of a shepherd than a monarch or a general or a CEO, then we cannot help but change the way we live. When that is who we follow, when that is our king, then it changes who we are and how we relate to our neighbors near and far. It changes how we move about this world and how we create spaces of dignity and justice. Jesus is a king known not by what he owns or acquires or controls, but by what he gives away. In this world, far too often, a king takes, a king extracts, a king exploits, or simply picks the surplus power up off of the ground. That is a term I hadn't heard until about a year ago. And then treats it as his own. Jesus is the king on the cross whose power comes from the act of self-emptying, of pouring out his very life. Rather than accumulating the sumptuous trappings of wealth and power, which plenty of religious folk do too, by the way, in the gospel, Jesus' only possessions, his clothes, were divided by lot and dispersed among the soldiers. What kind of king lets that happen? A king is known not by what he takes, but by what he gives away. A true king is known also not by what scores he can settle, but by his capacity for mercy. A king, Jesus, is a king who forgives. Jesus, in his suffering, does not give himself to the greater agony of resentment. He doesn't create the list. He doesn't call for the death or the imprisonment of the folks who put him there. He doesn't call his beloved disciple to the foot of the cross and say, quick, write this down to make sure that these people get what's coming to them. No. Jesus says, and I want you to hear every word of this, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Even in his moment of greatest pain, Jesus breaks the cycle of resentment by turning towards forgiveness. Hey, side note. I read in a blog this week about three things that are essential to cognitive longevity. Meaning, do these things and your brain will stay healthier longer, which is what we all want, right? It's by a neuroscientist named Julie Fratantoni. And one of these things that if you practice it, it will aid in cognitive longevity is forgiveness. Forgiveness. It's scientific research, but does that not ring true at a heart level? To forgive is to release a burden that is doing you no good. If you are withholding forgiveness, it is eating your brain. That is not the words that Dr. Fratantoni used, but the word I'm using them because I think it speaks just fine. Jesus is a king who forgives. And unlike the kings of this world who divide, who sow division to secure their own place, Jesus is a shepherd king who gathers the flock into union with God and with one another. That is actually everything you need to know. Jesus draws all people to himself to bind up their wounds, to heal creation, to restore the human family. The nations of the world, the tribes and partisans of this world cannot imagine this kind of eternal ingathering. They can only imagine campaign messaging and trade warfare and missile defense. They cannot imagine the wholehearted union into which Christ draws each and every one of us. And the verb that helps us to best understand the reign of God is not one of those kingly words, words like rule, dominate, win, govern, or even lead, but gather. Not expel, but gather. In Jeremiah, God will gather the remnants of the flock out of all lands to bring them back into the fold. God will gather the remnants of the flock out of all lands to bring us back into the fold. That remnant is us, followers of Jesus in every land, who pay their taxes and serve in the military and show up at the protests, but who ultimately have a deeper allegiance of the heart. And that remnant comes from Jeremiah, from the Old Testament. So we can think even more widely than that. It is people of faith and integrity whose citizenship in God's economy means bearing witness to a different way. With our actions, with our words, with our very being, it means bearing witness to a holier way of living in community with one another and in relationship with God. It means building nations and cities where folk have enough to eat and do not live in fear for their safety, where each is honored for who they are and who God created them to be. It means beating swords into plowshares and learning war no more. Christ's work is restoration and reconciliation. Christ restores all things, divided and enslaved by sin as we are, as the tribes and the nations of this world are. This, friends, is profoundly good news. It is good news for tomorrow, to be sure. But if we can lay claim to the gifts of Christ's reign, forgiveness, self-emptying, and this lifelong work of restoration, it will be salvation for our world today when we need it the most. Amen.